shines in me. There's a light in me. There's a light that shines in me. There's a light in me. There's a light that shines in me. There's a light in me.
Holy One that comes for peace.
There's a light that shines in me. There's a light in me.
Oh, come tell us we are free.
There's a light that shines in me. There's a light in me.
But I know I'll let it be.
There's a light that shines in me. There's a light in me. There's a light that shines in me. There's a light in me.
There's a light in me, there's a light in you, the light that shines in each of us. There's only one life, and that light is the life of good, the life of God, the life of the good that you proclaim that is showing up as each and every one of you. Thank you, and welcome to One Love Center. My name is Rodney Gittins, and I'm your host for today, and in just a little while, I'm going to introduce my co-host and our participant, our contributor, our wonderful friend and mentor, Reverend Walter Rasuli. So in just a brief moment, once again, welcome to One Love Center. This is a place where love grows. And at this moment, we would like to say hi and welcome to the Reverend Hajra Rahim and Reverend Walter Rasuli. Please say hello.
Hello, how is everyone this evening?
Most excellent. Hello, Hajra and Brother Rodney. Hello, hello.
Greetings. It brings me great joy from within. I'm learning my lessons. Great joy from within to participate once again with the One Love Center Presents, The Power of Now, book study on by Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. So,
you know, I want to ask you a question right away, don't you?
Sure, go ahead.
Is there really such a thing as without, as opposed to within?
Say that there is, and I think we're going to get into that a little later. So your prophetic energies are right where they should be. They're peaking as usual. But yeah, I would think that I guess we could just say with, neither in or out. It's just with.
So, you know, you're talking about, what did you say, something about the joy? How did you say your? How did you say it? What were you saying?
The great joy within.
Okay, we could just talk about the great joy
that
you are.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, thank you.
You know, because there's no within or without in oneness.
That's it. All there is
the
joy.
That's why the law of correspondence, which is what the law of correspondence says, as within, so without, as above, so below. So they correspond to one another because they're all related. It's relational,
right.
So, you know, there can be no distinction when you look at it like that. If the head side of the coin is flipping, the tail side of the coin is flipping.
That's right.
So what would you say?
Now, you see, that's only a small reason why we have you here today. Thank you.
Well, the trick is living it. It's easy to espouse it and, you know, sound philosophical, but, you know, like people like to say, how's that working out for you?
That's right. That's right. Yes, indeed. Like, I say and how we say, how are you treating life today? You know,
there it is.
It starts in the mind. And as does, now you see, I think what happens is, as with the power of now, and as you mentioned, the law of correspondence, if therefore, if I am believing there's an two sides to a coin, then I have to have the experience of two sides. I have to have the experience of an inner and an outer. However, I believe we can agree that joy does not begin anywhere from what would seem to be outside of us if there was an outside. If I believe that there's an outside and an inside, then that belief
there's only one place you there's only one place you can experience joy.
Uh-huh.
No matter what happened in your life, joy happens where?
Oh, inside.
Yeah, there's no outside to joy. I mean, joy is an inside job. So whatever's going on the outside is just helping you get in touch with what's going on in the inside.
Right.
Absolutely.
And what else are you saying? The outside can be a stimulus to what's going on in the inside.
Absolutely. Well, it's like a key or a doorway. It's like it shows
right.
you what's there. Now, we can pretend like it's not there. We can act like we don't know. You know, or be like when I lose my keys and they're on the table the whole time. I've searched the table 5 times, but I didn't see the keys for whatever reason. That doesn't mean it's not there. It means that for some reason I'm denying myself access. And so it looks like something or something is keeping my joy away from me, but it's a matter of perception. You know, I have a friend of mine. I was talking to her about this, and she said, watch, it's so bad that if I look for something and I know it's in that certain place, I'll ask my sister. I said, look, I've looked in this drawer 3 times. I know my keys are in there. I just can't see them. Her sister will look at the same drawer and say, well, there they are right there. They're right under your nose.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
for some reason you're out of phase and you don't have access to it because, you know, I mean, I'm out of phase. I don't have access to it because I'm tripping on one form of duality or another that hides them from me. I mean, right in front of me. They're right there. And I can't see them.
Right.
I think we've all experienced that.
Oh,
right.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
That's the segue to jump in.
Thank you. Thank you for that opening lesson.
Anyway, I guess I'm glad to see you. I need some philosophical conversation today, so thank you for your program.
Well, welcome aboard, and we welcome everyone who's listening live and those who are joining us in the archives. Welcome aboard. So, One Love Center.
You know,
yeah, go ahead.
I need to say one thing before, because I'm in Maryland right now visiting family, Maryland,
what?
Virginia area. Yeah.
Hey, family.
So where I am now, the reception is very spotty. So sometimes it just may disconnect. So if I, you know, disappear, I'll call back. But it
okay.
does that.
All right. Thank you. Okay. So This is One Love Center Presents, and this is One Love Center, represented by myself, Rodney Giddens, a religious science practitioner, and Hajar Rahim, who is now a licensed minister. And
yay.
Welcome her. Yes, indeed. And we are members of Centers for Spiritual Living. One Love Center is a Brooklyn teaching chapter. Indeed, a place where love grows. We are lovingly created as a community of fellowship, meditation, prayer, sacred service, spiritually supported healing services, and spiritual speakers. We have musical transformances, and you have to come to see what that is, study workshops, and spiritual films. Our next Sunday celebration is Sunday, July 20th. And myself, Rodney Giddens, will be the featured speaker. So once again, all are welcome. We start at 11:30 a.m. We meet at 886 Pacific Street in Brooklyn, New York, 11236. The venue is The Village at Gerege Renate Albertson Martin Gallery. We affectionately call it The Village at Gerege, 886 Pacific Street. And wonderful venue, a lot of other great activities go on there. And we are also going to have an awesome concert there in August. So we invite you to check in and to contact us. We can be reached at 917-755-1418. And this is One Love Center. And it is our mission to provide a stable and welcoming community for all who choose to practice and grow, play, and unfold their understanding of spiritual principles and spiritual living. And we do have a vision, and that vision is to see the world as a sacred environment where spiritual growth and development flourish through living in the practice of spiritual principles. Now, we know this vision not only for ourselves, but for the world. And so we see that, and in that way we provide what we are doing now, a book study on the power of now. And just for the next moment, I'd like to have Reverend Marcia Rasuli introduce himself and talk about where he's from. And go ahead, take it away.
Well, I'm Reverend Marcia Rasuli, and I'm the senior minister, community spiritual leader of the San Francisco Center for Spiritual Living, 280 Claremont Boulevard, San Francisco, California. And we are a very loving and inclusive community. Our mission is to promote the healing and the transformation of the planet through the application and the understanding of the whole oneness of God. Now, I'm paraphrasing that because I have not memorized it, so I have to work on that. But what I do know is that every Sunday, an eclectic group of loving and committed souls come together with the realization that, indeed, their consciousness is making a difference on the planet. And we welcome you and invite you to join us, whomsoever may. And so thank you for the opportunity, Dr. Rodney.
You're very welcome. Thank you. And we're going to jump into the power of now. We've been talking about Chapter 9. All right, we've been in Chapter 9, Beyond Happiness and Unhappiness, There is Peace. And it's been really a great, great, and I have to admit, we've been in it longer than I thought we would. It has really brought up a lot of stuff. Now, where we just left off in our opening conversation talking about joy, I'm looking in the hardcover edition, page 155. Last week we were talking about releasing negativity. We were talking about the peace of God, the joy of being. And in the middle of 155, he goes on to say, nothing can give you joy. Joy is uncaused and arises from within as the joy of being. It's an essential part of the inner state of peace, the state that has been called the peace of God. It is your natural state, not something that you need to work hard for or struggle to attain. And I like that part. And it certainly is a natural state, and I really would agree with you, Mawatsa, when you said, yeah, you know, actually there is no outside or inside. It's just our natural state of being. I think sometimes we look at it as an inside, and I think when we do that, it kind of means we have to kind of look for it, you know, or search for it or bring it forth, rather than the idea of a state of being, which is just, that's just my natural state. It's inside, outside, or not inside or outside. It just is.
It just is, yes. I'm fortunate this week because I'm here visiting my grandkids, and there's a six-month-old baby. You just look at him, he just starts to giggle and smile. He just lights up just by looking at him. And you don't have to do anything, but just look at him. And he sees you, and he just giggles, and he just lights up, and he's just happy, joyful being. And I always say, look at the children. That's what our natural state looks like. They are happy just because they are here. They're just happy just for being present and being witnessed, and they are just happy being. So, no, you don't have to earn it. You don't have to struggle for it. You just are it expressing itself out as you. And when he was doing that, you know, he just started just giggling. He just, whenever anybody came by, you know, he would just go into his state of ecstasy. And I'm like, that's it. That's what we're talking about. And we get
so far
away from
it. Very much like the joy of being, where nothing has to really occur. I mean, sometimes we're being the observer, but we also seem to have some kind of influence in what we are observing.
Right.
However, sometimes we might just be passing by and see a joyful-looking baby, you know, and it doesn't seem like there's any kind of outside influence for that baby to be looking joyful. You know, and we say happy, and usually happy to me means there's a happening, that something has to occur for us to then decide, you know, how we're going to feel about it, if we're going to actually enact our joy and in a physical expression that we would call happiness, you know, that people get to see it.
Right.
So, you know, I think that joy and happiness are sometimes synonymous, and most times, especially metaphysically speaking, not synonymous.
Right.
Happiness is the experience the experience of a something causing it, some causation. Because not everything that happens will make everybody happy, you know.
Right.
But joy doesn't depend on anything to happen, right? Would anybody agree or disagree with that?
Well, I have a question first. What is if I were to look this up on the internet, is there a website that I would go to get to you, like if I were to tell somebody to tune in?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Absolutely. The website to tune in information is, and I'll get that for you in just a moment, you would go to blogtalkradio.com.
blogtalkradio.com. .com.
/... One Love Center.
One Love Center?
Yes. And that will lead them to the show live and archive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the live show and archive. So what I would say first, and so now my grandchildren have just come into the room, and so I'm looking at the most darling angelic face ever.
Sounds like a grandparent to me.
You think I'm talking about her? You think I'm talking about you, huh? She said, I know you're talking about me, grandfather. And so from what I hear you saying, I mean, listen, what we're talking about, you know, there's a quote by Rumi, I believe. Yes, Rumi. Beyond right doing and wrong doing, there's a field.
And
I'll meet you there.
Right.
You know? And there's something else beautiful attached to that quote, but that's the part I remember right now. And so the joy that you're talking about, for me, you know, as I understand and as I experience consciousness, the joy is really in the observation of my own self. You know, that's what being, this is how I'm experiencing being right now. It's like I can be, you know, you said something about, and I like the way you said that, about something about the observer. Sometimes you interact even though you're the observer. Remember how you said that, Rodney?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so what I... So my spin on that, you know, my take with that is, you know, as you observe yourself engaging life, that's the trick, is to always reflect back to the observer position. It's not that you sometimes engage and sometimes you're always engaging life, but you always want to remember that even though there's a you that's engaging life, there's another you that has the power to observe you engaging it. And I think we've all had those experiences where we observed ourselves do something. You say, all of a sudden I saw myself do this. Okay, I witnessed, you know, I mean, sometimes I've been partying. You know, it doesn't even have to be a real spiritual thing for the observer to show up. I've partied so hard. I stood outside of myself and watched myself do it. And so when you can observe with a consciousness of wholeness and realize that, you know, the good and the bad that I've been programmed to believe is a reality is just it's a perspective of how I interact in life. But that who I really am and what life really is about is something beyond that. And so I often find it, this is how it shows up for me. I'm talking around in circles, but something will be going on. And we'll be having a conversation. And unfortunately, I'd like to say I'm holy enough that I really get this through divine inspiration. But oftentimes what happens is something is really on my nerves, okay?
Uh-huh.
Something is really annoying me. And there's a part of me that wants to go out there and handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see that person who wants to handle it. It's like I hear myself making all the excuses and having all the conversations in my mind about what's wrong and who's done what to who and why it's not fair. And as I observe myself doing that, that's where my joy is, because I'm no longer caught up in the story. It's like, I'm telling the story again. I'm trying to engage at that same level again. And as I observe that, there's actually a little smile, you know, that comes in the observation, because I realize, you know, this is something that I'm experiencing as real, but it's not real. The reality is the fact that I know how. Yeah, thank you. But you know what I'm trying to say here?
Yes, I do. What I would say to that, along those lines, and this is my particular thought about that type of a thing, is that we experience life. And we witness our experience of life, and we witness ourselves as we are experiencing life. And so the life that we live is an accumulation of different experiences that we've had down through our time on this planet, but it's about the experiences. And we can be outside of the experience and see the experience, you know, and know that, I'm experiencing this at this time. And it's like the observer itself is looking at the subjective self and saying, hey, we're experiencing this, you know, and that's what it is. It's an experience. And, one of the quotes in the Bible says, and this too shall pass.
Yes.
You know, and so we talk about the moment-by-moment living and just realizing, and I'm just becoming more and more conscious of my moment, you know, and each moment is a moment in time, but it's an accumulation of the moments that we live. And if we, you know, so I'm practicing being conscious of my moments when they're happening.
Well, that's awesome. And actually, Chandra, that's where we left off pretty much last week, talking about the moment.
Right.
And it says, on page 161 about the story of Ban Zan.
Right.
That he became a great Zen master, spent many years in pursuit of enlightenment, but it eluded him. Then one day, as he was walking in the marketplace, he overheard a conversation between a butcher and his customer. "Give me the best piece of meat you have," said the customer. And the butcher replied, "Every piece of meat I have is the best. There is no piece of meat here that is not the best." Upon hearing this, Ban Zan became enlightened. He said, "I can see you're waiting for some explanation. When you accept what is, every piece of meat, every moment, is the best. That is enlightenment." So it sounds, Hadra, like you are certainly on your path of enlightenment, being and enjoying every moment, being aware of the moment.
Being aware of the moment, yes.
And I think that it's our practice to not be attached to any of those moments either.
Right. Whether we call them good or bad, because whichever one it is, it this too shall pass. And that's the practice of living in what they call equanimity, one of those words, where you stay in neutral because you're observing. It's like watching a movie. You're observing this movie of your life, and you see yourself as the star in this movie, but, you know, you're there looking at yourself doing this stuff, and it passes. The frames pass. And to not judge it as good or bad, but just judge it as an experience and learn from that experience, because you're going to apply those lessons later down the road in another moment that comes up.
So let me ask you. Once you have gained this enlightenment, or anybody or someone or anyone or everyone gains this enlightenment, do the words good and bad become non-existent? Because if you're, I mean, is it even living in neutral? Because neutral against what?
Yeah. You know what, I thought about that also. If it's not good, if it's not bad, if it's neutral, it's an experience. And so what I came to conclusion with is, what is your preference? What experience would you prefer to have? And I would prefer chocolate versus strawberry ice cream, you know?
Right.
I wouldn't call the chocolate good or the strawberry bad. I just prefer the chocolate. And so then we can live our lives at that point once we understand it in preferences. And
mm-hmm.
so we can have the experience that we prefer to have, so that we can enjoy that even more and let that pass and have another preferred experience come, but not be stuck in the good or the bad of it.
Right,
in the
okay.
preference of it, yeah.
Great. Thank you. So that actually moves us into the next paragraph after we've done a rather loose and fast summary of the chapter previously. We move to the nature of compassion. And as Eckhart Tolle presents it, and Hadra, this relates exactly to what you were speaking. But before I go on, I'm going to invite somebody else who's called up and see if they'd like to say anything. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hi, who do we have here on the line today?
This is Piranjali, and...
Well, hi, greetings and welcome, Piranjali. So good to have you here.
It's good to be here. How are you doing today?
Excellent. And we have another caller. I just want to see if they'd like to say hello. Hello. Okay, may not be able to, but if you get an opportunity, just say hello. Press number one if you'd like to add anything, say anything, and I'll know that you're there, and we'll let you say hi to the group. So, and welcome aboard, Piranjali. It's so good to have you, and I'm sure we'll get some wonderful insights from you as well. I'm not sure how much you've already heard, but we're about to move into the nature of compassion.
Mm.
And Hadra, the newly licensed Center for Spiritual Living minister, Reverend Hajira, at the One Love Center here in Brooklyn, New York. She had just finished talking about being in every moment, and once you get to that place, you kind of start to feel very deep, and I think that's how you mentioned it, Hajira.
Yeah.
Eckhart Tolle starts off the nature of compassion by saying, having gone beyond the mind-made opposites, and that's the mind-made opposites of good and bad, or right or wrong, and all of that, he says, you become like a deep lake. The outer situation of your life and whatever happens there is the surface of the lake, sometimes calm, sometimes windy and rough, according to the cycles and seasons. Deep down, however, the lake is always undisturbed. You are the whole lake, not just the surface, and you are in touch with your own depth, which remains absolutely still. You don't resist change by mentally clinging to any situation. Your inner peace does not depend on it. You abide in being, capital B, being, unchanging, timeless, deathless, and you are no longer dependent for fulfillment or happiness on the outer world of constantly fluctuating form. You can enjoy them, play with them, create new forms, appreciate the beauty of it all, but there will be no need to attach yourself to any of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And so that begins the conversation of compassion.
Hmm.
So, does anybody have any statements on that last paragraph, which is the hardcover Power of Now, page 161 to 162?
Yeah, I have a comment on that. It says, the last sentence, the second to last sentence, it says, you can enjoy them, play with them, create new forms, appreciate the beauty of it all, but there will be no need to attach yourself to any of it. And again, that's true when you get to that state of equanimity where you see all things as they are, you see what is without the attachment to it, which is what Buddhism teaches. Suffering comes from attachment, not from the experience, but from the attachment that you have, that emotional attachment you have to it. Take, for instance, when you decide to clean your closet and there are some articles in your closet that you are attached to because of the memories that those articles bring to your mind. They have no meaning in and of themselves. I mean, they were made, you bought it, you wore it, you know? So the article of clothing really does not have an inherent meaning in it, but we place our attachment, our memories to it, and then we can't let it go because I remember when, you know, you go down memory lane. So what he's saying here is you can enjoy them, you can play with them, you can create new forms, you can appreciate the beauty, but there'll be no need to attach yourself to it. And so once you have used that garment, you've worn that garment, it's time to let it go, either to give it away because it's still good or to just discard it because you can no longer use it. But you don't have to suffer any emotional devastation because you had to let it go.
No.
So that's how I
don't want to let go of those jeans. You know, you get holes in your jeans and you make shorts out of them. Yeah, I created something new, you know. It doesn't look like attachment, you know. It's my favorite jeans.
It's
not
your favorite jeans. Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
Mom
yeah.
had to throw out those funky sneakers, you know, before I got a new pair, you know. Like, they had to go. Favorite sneakers.
Yeah, but that's what we're talking about.
Everybody else was suffering. It wasn't me.
And we can appreciate it. We can appreciate it. We can appreciate it. And we can bless it. And we can let it go. And I think getting to that point, you know, it's a process. It's a process of enlightenment. Because enlightenment is all about letting go. It's not about attaching yourself to stuff. It's about letting go of the misunderstandings and the misinformation and the misteaching, the miseducation that we have had. And there's a lot of stuff that we believe, that we have been taught, that is not true, capital T. And that's one of the things about attachment, because this too shall pass. You know, if there's a time, you're going to have to let those genes go.
Yes.
They're going to have to go. And you don't have to suffer when they leave, you know. But you can appreciate and remember when you had those genes. That was a good experience with those genes. But now you got a new pair of genes. Or you moved to slack.
So then what brings to a point of realization? This
right.
is for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
Eckhart Tolle says, suffering is due to identification with form.
Right.
And Hadra, you're saying, well, all you have to do is let it go, you
uh-huh.
know, and appreciate it and let it go. But how do you get to that point?
Right,
and I
exactly.
and this is Pierre Angeli, and I think that that is one of the great paradoxes of a conscious spiritual life, because, you know, we say in science of mind, in religious science, that we're one with everything, and that is also something that the great mystical teachings of most belief systems say, that there's a great oneness to life. So that really means that you're a part of everything. We're actually not separate from it. And I think this is where it becomes confusing for people, because when we think of detachment, we literally think that it means separating from something, detaching. If you were to look up that word, it's one of its definitions. But being one with everything, knowing that you're a part of a universal whole, one divine life, therefore not separate from anything, and at the same time knowing that there's more to that life than what's taking place at the material level. This is, for me, why, you know, the amazing Maya Angelou, who just passed, could write about the caged bird singing of freedom, because it's not
right.
defined by its bars. And I think
right.
that's really being able to transcend whatever circumstances you are, to be able to access a love that's not material bound, that it is compassion. And so I want to really, you know, talk about that. That is not always the easiest thing to do. I think that we
right.
sometimes use phrases like, you know, just let it go, and it's true.
Right.
It's the work, but it's simple, but it's not that easy. And I think about
right.
the people who have experienced a profound love and a profound loss, let's say, people who have had someone taken in their family by violence, and then they go to court and argue compassionately not to have the person who took their loved one given the death sentence. That's
right.
a level of compassion that isn't quite, you know, I'm detached and I'm just letting it go. It's transcending something
mm-hmm.
into a
mm-hmm.
much deeper place of knowing that love is rooted far beyond what we're experiencing at the physical level. And that, to me, is really what compassion is about. And it can be for something small, it can be for something large, but it's sort of like the daily work of what we're here to do, is to find that place of compassion within us.
You said something profound in terms of the level of the human being, because we are multi-level, multi-faceted beings. And so
absolutely.
The physical is at, quote-unquote, in a way of trying to understand it, at the lower level of form, you know. But that form comes out of the consciousness, out of the invisible, into that form, which is a temporary thing. All forms are temporary. And
mm-hmm.
so once we realize that all forms are temporary, and we become the watcher and creating the forms that we then experience, and we do this every day, we decide what we want to have for dinner. The dinner's not on the table yet, you know? We go out, we get the stuff, we cook the dinner, and now we have the dinner that we had thought we had. We wanted, but we created that dinner out of our desire to have that dinner, you know? And so God created creation out of his desire to experience life through and in and as us. And we experience this life on these different levels, and we're talking about attachment to the level of form, you know? And once we realize that those forms are going to come and go all the time, that's just how this life is, then we can let that go. And having compassion comes from not that physicality of the world, but it comes from that higher plane of understanding that it's about the creation, it's about the experience, and that experience was a temporary thing, but we rise higher in our consciousness through that level of knowing.
So my question is...
where we all are one.
Yeah,
yes.
my question is, without this book and without this conversation, how does somebody get to that realization? How do they get to a point of recognizing their higher self, their, you know, the consciousness of oneness, or the experience of oneness, the knowingness of oneness? How do we get to that point?
Well, I would say that it really depends on an individual and how committed they are to being there, because Hajra, well, everybody, Pure Anjali, Hajra, yourself, I think we're all making excellent points here. I like the one that she left off on because it was rattling around in my head a little bit different way when you said how do you, once again, you came back to the how. And mm-hmm. I think the how happens when we begin to understand that there's literally, literally more to us than flesh and bones. That who I am
right.
is not a being of form. The reason
right.
why we have so much trouble letting go of the form of things is because we're convinced that we ourselves are form.
Right.
And as long as we continue to believe that who I am is the physical being, then it then physicalness, form becomes essential to my survival. I think at
right.
some point there's an understanding where we realize that there's more to me than what's going on around me, more than my environment. There's something that connects me to the individual. The Good Samaritan felt connected to that man who'd been beaten on the side of the road. Mother Teresa feels connected. The entire world right now who's responding to the kidnapped girls in Nigeria, there's something in us that is responding viscerally. I believe compassion happens when we actually have a physical reaction to the spiritual connection, which is always present. And we cannot deny that physical reaction to something spiritual that's going on, which is why Mother Teresa had to go to Calcutta, which is why, you know, Martin had to do what he did. It is why each of us stands up and does the compassionate things that we do, because there's a connection that is so sound, so solid, and so irrefutable that we cannot deny it, and we begin to act from that place.
Right.
Wonderful.
Yes.
So
one of the things that comes up is, and that he's talking about, and what's also been mentioned by Hajra, and is suffering. So in that state of suffering, when we are so locked up in our belief of form, you know, that we are our body and that form and that power is outside of ourselves, and we are affected by outside influences, that I think it's the identification of suffering that begins to lead us out of suffering. You know,
I think that's really interesting, Rodney, that what you're speaking of, because, I mean, some of the great examples that we have of people who have been the most compassionate, you know, Reverend Mawata just mentioned a few. He talked about Martin Luther King. He talked about Mother Teresa. We could talk about Viktor Frankl. We could talk, you know, about Nelson Mandela. The list is pretty endless of people who, when you actually, they stand for great compassion, also either placed themselves or were placed in circumstance of history in some deep places of what most people would define as suffering. You know, you could go on. You could say Anne Frank, et cetera. And for each of those individuals, it was, as I mentioned earlier, transcending whatever was taking place at that physical, material level of suffering to a deeper knowing of who they were. And thereby, knowing who they were able to redefine their circumstance to say, I still believe that people are good at heart, or you cannot make me hate you, or that I'm going to come out of prison and lead this country into reconciliation. You know, that for every one of these individuals, it was a transcendence of what we might consider suffering. I think what is, again, the biggest paradox in spirituality is that we look at these, you might call them grand cases, and we can have this admiration for an individual who can do this. But the truth be told is, if you're standing in back of in a grocery line and somebody has 18 items in front of you and they're only supposed to have 15 because that's what the sign says, if a thought of separation and anger runs through your mind, you are not in a state of compassion. Right. And so it doesn't have to be these grand gestures of humanity that activate our compassion. And I honestly believe that if we could practice this on a daily basis, the small things, someone cuts you off on the freeway, what is your internal response?
Mm-hmm.
What is your consciousness dictating in that moment? I love this question because it's often used in, you know, literature, just everyday life. Who do you think you are? You know, and if it's said with that tone and that energy, it's a challenge to me. But actually, it's a really profound question that at almost any given moment, if I can internally ask myself right now in this moment, who do I think I am?
Mm-hmm.
And if I can answer that in my divine awareness that I am a presence of God, that this individual with me, that this circumstance, whatever is taking place, is a manifestation of the Holy Spirit, then I can move within that circumstance in a greater compassion for myself and for everyone than if I answer that question very differently.
Absolutely.
That's how I think you start getting there. Is
well,
that
you know,
question?
The thing
who
is,
do I think I am?
Right, absolutely, and I love that, and I use that from time to time in my talks, and that's what Eckhart Tolle is talking about when we have identification with the ego, and
usually when
we start off asking that question, it certainly is from an ego or egotistical point of view. You know, who do you think you are? And even when we begin to look inward with that question. We're not going to try to. We're going to try to pretty it up, you know. Well, just who do I think
right.
I am, you know? And if I stick with the truth in that moment, you know, about how I'm thinking and maybe behaving or reacting, you know, it's not going to be as pretty as I would truly like it to be. So mm-hmm. I think what you said, Pierre Anjali, reminds me of a great billboard that maybe we could put up everywhere around where we live that says, just who do you think you are? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
or just who do I think I am? You know? Mm-hmm. And have, so in some way, get people to ask that question of themselves. Because
yeah.
I think that's a good start for getting out of the ego, for disabling the ego, or disempowering the ego from the way that we have empowered it. And
mm-hmm.
so I think that's really important. That's a wonderful question. You know,
yeah.
Who was it? Was it a president or somebody? Oh, the mayor of New York, Edward Koch, used to say, hey, everybody, how am I doing? You know,
mm-hmm.
and not that it mattered what they said, because it didn't. You know,
right.
it was his way of trying. I think trying to be humble and like, hey guys, you know, how am I doing? Tell me how great I am. Tell me how wonderful I'm doing. You know,
yeah,
because
yeah.
of course, I'm sure he didn't want any mud coming back in his face.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. So, but yeah,
the Bible, Jesus, when they were questioning him, and they asked him, "Who was he? Who are you?" He says, who do you say that I am? And then they had to reflect back and answer that question to him, who they thought he was. And I remember one of the assignments that we had when I first began the ministerial school is we had to contact, it was 20 or 30 people that we knew in different areas, aspects of our lives, and have them reflect back to us how they felt about us, to tell us what was the positive characteristics that we had and how that was exemplified in their life. And it was amazing feedback because we don't really know who we are. We are reflected back by others to ourselves because it's the mirror. And it took me a long time to understand the mirroring effect. But other people mirror us back to ourselves. And we say, oh, so that's who they think I am. Sometimes they may be spot on with who you think you are, and sometimes they may not be on with who you think you are. You know, it's just a phenomenal effect, but it's a reflection back to yourself of what other people think about you that gives you a clue as to where you think you fall in that that category. I thought that was an amazing feedback. And a lot of times we don't even know what other people think of us in terms of how we have presented ourselves and how they have received that presentation until after the fact. But it's an amazing experience that I had when I asked that question. And I got all kinds of feedback on it. It was a good thing.
Yeah, I've done
that. Doing an exercise like that can really be interesting. I know it's used in a number of different places of kind of getting in touch with this idea of authenticity and
right.
and also that humility that you mentioned earlier, that if you are projecting out what you think you are, but it may not. So, you know, intention doesn't always equal impact that you're making.
Right.
And
I
also think that question, who do you think you are, really invites us to go beyond what we've been telling ourselves or projecting onto the world about who we think we are or what other people may give us in terms of feedback. I think that's
right.
why the question is so deep, because it invites something more than that. Each of us
right.
could give a list of all the qualities of what we think we are, all the ways we have maybe defined ourselves, all the roles that we've played. The same thing's true for how anybody else might perceive us or see us. And at the deepest part of our being, we are more than that.
Yes,
and it is
right.
the more than that that is called upon to access compassion, because it's easy to feel compassion when you don't feel hurt, when you
right.
don't feel pain. It's when the part of you that doesn't feel strong enough to love in this circumstance, that feels depleted in this circumstance, who do you think you are now? And that is a question that only we can answer, and it is one that calls on us to answer much beyond anything we have believed about ourselves, mostly up until that point. I like my mother-in-law says, you know, children will bring you to your knees
right.
because, you know, it's that depth of love for something. And it could be something other than your children. It can be a parent. It can be a spouse. It can be anything, really, a pet for some people. But that depth of profound love that also causes us to have to dig beyond where we thought we could go, that's the place where compassion is. I thought when I was calling in that I had heard Reverend Mawata paraphrasing Rumi with that out beyond a field of right and wrong, there is a place of compassion, a place of love, and I shall meet you there. And that's that aspect of I've got to move past what my thoughts are about myself, about this situation, about anybody else to access that place that is pure divine love, compassion.
That's interesting because, and thank you so much for that, Pierre Angeli. That is awesome. And Eckhart Tolle says, compassion is the awareness of a deep bond between yourself and all creatures.
Yes, yeah.
And it's like, in a way, it's not saying love between myself and all, it's just a deep bond. It's like, to me, it's just
yes.
like oneness. You know, it's
yes.
like, it's like almost the answer to the question of who do I think I am is like, I am you and you. Was that the Beatles song?
Yes.
I am you and you are me and we are, you know, all together.
Right,
stuff,
right.
You know.
The answer to the question, who do I think I am, comes back for me. And I see it gets just how deep down the rabbit hole do you really want to go?
Okay,
yeah.
Because what happens for me is when they say...
Some of us are like, I'll stand here and look at the rabbit hole, thank you very much.
You know what I'm saying? Well, and some of us are like, what rabbit hole? I didn't see no rabbit, you know?
Right.
And so, because, you know, it says, well, who do I think I am? It's like, well, who's asking the question?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the answer. It's like, who's asking who do I think I am?
And why do you
yeah.
want to know?
When you get... Yeah.
yeah.
Like, who's asking? Well, I'm asking. Well, who is the I that's asking, who do I think I am? And if you keep
yeah.
drilling down on that, you know, this I think, Pierre Angeli, everybody, we're all saying good stuff here. But the thing that's sticking out for me about remembering who you are is, and we got to go back to Howard Thurman, and part of me has been distracted because I've been looking for the full quote here. And in the last verse, you know, he says, in the quietness of this place,
yeah.
surrounded by the all-pervading presence of God, my heart whispers, keep fresh before me my moments of high resolve, that in fair weather or foul, in good times or in tempest, in the days when the darkness and the foe are nameless or familiar, I may not forget that to which my life is committed. Keep fresh before me my moments of high resolve. And so that's like, I want to always remember the truth that I've always known. And sometimes, you know, he talks earlier about how the grit and the dust of life just creep into our awareness and they dull our memory and they dull our commitment to being fully authentic with the way we show up in the world. And when that happens, we lose the moment of now. And we try to live in the past. We try to correct past hurts. Or we try to, you know, try to guard ourselves against future anxieties. And it's only in this present state that we can have the moment of high resolve. It's happening in the now. And that's why he's saying keep it fresh. You know, keep it vibrant. Keep it alive. We have to attend to it.
That's lovely. Thank you for reminding me of that. It's one of my favorite pieces by Howard Thurman. I think it's in that same writing where he says, I had forgotten how easy it is to forget.
To forget. That's exactly the same piece. He's, I've forgotten how, and we forget how easy it is to forget. You know, I talk about Reverend Emo. When you say my mother-in-law, she had this one. She said, it's like a game of pin the tail on the dog, and you see everybody else getting spun around and they can't find the donkey, and you think, well, if they put that blindfold on me, I'm sure they're going to be able to find the donkey because it's just not that hard. But what you don't realize is what happens when your equilibrium gets spun out of control like that. Once they spin you, you know, then you lose your equilibrium, and we don't realize that that life has a way to cause our spiritual equilibrium to be off balance just a bit.
The swirl. We're in the swirl. listen, I want to thank you all for this blessing. Reverend Mowata mentioned earlier that our granddaughter is here, and she is calling my name. So I'm going to go to a place where it's really easy to remember because there's nothing like being around a child that will immediately help you to remember who you are.
That's right.
So thank you all very much. Peace and blessings and love to you all. And I'm going to go ahead and go be here with her.
Thank you. Peace and blessings to you, and have a great time.
Absolutely. And hello to Brenda for me.
Yeah, she's listening.
Excellent. Send in love.
Go ahead and tell her.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you so much. How awesome. All right, and that really does lead us more into compassion. Eckhart Tolle on page 163 is talking about the spiritual practice. And one of the ways to get in touch with...
What's the subtitle of talk?
It starts really on the nature of compassion. And then there are some questions, like, is that what compassion is? And he says, compassion is the awareness of a deep bond between yourself and all creatures.
I'm really loving the fact that he defined it that way, and that's pretty much the way I defined it without reading it. So I'm like, you know, I could validate that he knows what he's talking about now.
I'm sure he'll be glad to hear that. Make sure you let him know that.
Yeah.
Well, next time you speak to him. He says, also, next time you say, I have nothing in common with this person, remember that you have a great deal in common. He says, a year from now, a few years from now, or 2 years, or 70 years, it doesn't much make difference, both of you will have become rotting corpses, then piles of dust, then nothing at all. He says, this is a sobering and humbling realization that leaves little room for pride. Is this a negative thought? No, it is a fact. Why close your eyes to it? In that sense, there is total equality between you and every other creature. And so if nothing else, we have compassion because of our oneness with the cycles of life. Even if we don't see any other similarity, we have that.
Well, we're all breathing the same air, so we always have that in common.
Yeah.
You know, and we there's only one water source. We're all tied into that same water source, so we have that in common. And like you said, we're all going to, you know, I mean, they can put enough preservatives in our body that, you know, they can embalm us just like the Egyptians. And, no, we don't have to have a rotting corpse, but we will at some point we're going to abandon the body for, you know, another existence. I mean, that's a sure bet. Nobody's going to stay in the body forever. And
that
so
we know
certainly have that in common. Yeah, that we know of. And so we all have some kind of language, whether it's the same one or not, sign language, you know, even body language. You know, we all use language, so we all have that in similarity. There, you know, we can go on. You know, the fact that we're mammals, unless we have that with that disease of Pascia, I guess it is, we're all covered with hair in one form or another. You know, there's too many similarities to talk about what's different about us.
Right.
You know, and now, we start talking about DNA strands, then we really start talking about what makes a human, and we're all the same.
Yeah, so he ends this little section by saying one of the most powerful spiritual practices is to meditate deeply on the mortality of physical forms, including your own. This is called die before you die. Go into it deeply. Your physical form is dissolving, is no more. Then a moment comes when all mind forms or thoughts also die, yet you are still there, the divine presence that you are, radiant, fully awake. Nothing that was real ever died, only names, forms, and illusions. And so he's saying that meditation brings us into a realization of compassion as well. And he moves on in this chapter to talk about the deathless dimension, your true nature. He calls this the other side of compassion. On the level of form, you share mortality and the precariousness of existence. On the level of being, you share eternal, radiant life. These are the two aspects of compassion. I guess that's if we were to believe that there were two aspects of compassion, then that could be two aspects of compassion, or the two only aspects of compassion, the way he seems to put it. He says, true compassion goes beyond empathy or sympathy. It does not happen until sadness merges with joy, the joy of being beyond form, the joy of eternal life. And we can work our way back from that. And that's on page 163 and 164 in the hardcover. So he's calling this the peace of God, a deep inner peace, when we move beyond the seemingly opposite feelings of sadness and joy, when they become one. It's like, I guess it's also when good and bad are merged, where there is no such thing as either or, good or bad. That's the state of peace, the peace of God. Well, I like to call it serenity. Thank you very
yeah, absolutely. But, you know, there's that whole thing about the feeling of right doing and wrong doing again. I mean, basically, when he says the realization of this deathless dimension, your true nature, is on the other side of compassion. He's saying the realization of this deathless dimension, okay, this deathless dimension is your true nature. It's on the other side of compassion. Compassion is a step you get to the place where you truly exist. And it's like, I this might be a horrible analogy, but this is what comes up for me. Maybe it's because I have two ex-wives, and so I've had to deal with this, you know, on a consistent and daily level, you know, because I remember hating them, you know, even not aware that I hated them, because I was in too much pain to even know how much I hated them, you know, and I finally got through the pain to realize how much I hated them. And then I got too conscious to have the hating. And so I got too conscious to have the hating, but that threw me back into more pain because now I can get to the pain that was underneath the hate and the, you know, and that. Then I had to walk through all of that to where I could accept the fact that This is a loving soul who was actually loving me, giving me the best that she had. She brought children of mine into the world because she was trying to, you know, be that person that I expected her to be, even though she was doing it in her own particular way. At some point, I got through all the different forms of duality and separation and pain and hurt that I was going through, and I reach a place where I have a sense of who these women are that's beyond my experience of them, my personal experience of them. And I see them to be God-centered, godly beings, loving souls. I'm having a different relationship with them because I'm having a different relationship with myself. And as I walk through all the pain and all the fear and all the rage and all the things I walk through, I had to develop a deeper sense of my high resolve. And in that awareness of who I am, I immediately know who they are. And so this is not about me being compassionate or having sympathy for them or even having empathy because I know their pain. It's about I understand the true nature of what beingness is. And beingness is that each of us and all of us and every single one of us is representation of the one thing, which is the divine, which is which is the expression of harmony in all existence. And so I believe this is what he's describing. It's, you know, it's getting this is deep down the rabbit hole here. Okay, this is not for lightweights, you know, but for those who can keep pace with the conversation that he's having. He's saying that the true self, the true you, the person who's always looking to emerge and be present, is on the other side of all feelings of compassion and sympathy and all of that, because that's the person who's observing me go through all those changes. He's on the other side of that. He's like, oh, there you are, trying to be upset about some stuff again because you're identified with something that's not you. And because you're identifying with something that's not you, you're trying to defend something that's not yours. If you're trying to defend something that's not yours, you find that to be a futile gesture, and you begin to lose. And when you begin to lose, you get frustrated and afraid, and it starts the whole process all over again.
Right.
And Muktananda has a good book called Getting Rid of What You Haven't Got.
Wow, that's some title. Wow. But you know,
I bought the book for the title and didn't read it because I just loved it. Getting rid of what I haven't got. I felt like I got it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Oh, I get this book.
Well, you know, we're talking about who we truly are. And one of the things I tell my grandchildren about who they are, what their essence is, I said, when you go to sleep at night and you dream, and in your dreams you go all over the place. And you can go anywhere instantaneously in one place or the other. But where is your body while you're dreaming, while you're sleeping? Is your body moving out of the bed and doing all this stuff? And they say, no, my body's still in the bed. I'm like, right, so you are not your body. You are that dreamer. You are the dreamer. You're the one who's dreaming.
Yes.
And in that dream, you can create the experiences that you want to have. And, you know, when we do dream therapy, we've become conscious dreaming. We can create our dreams, and we can change our dreams in the middle of dreaming. If something is going on in a dream that we don't like, we can change it, you know, and do something else or come out of that dream and go somewhere else. And it's just amazing. And I think about that. That's who I am. I am that dreamer. I am not this body.
Well, even, you know, I'd like to expand on it,
sure.
Because there's a story that Muktananda tells, and it's one of my favorite stories ever. I probably told it to Rodney a dozen times. And a story about a rich man who's in a garden, in his garden, eating figs and grapes, and he's being fanned by a servant. You know the story, right?
Right.
And so, you know, he dreams about being beaten by a penniless beggar in an orchard. And he takes the fruit illegally, and the owner starts to beat him. And he within an inch of his life, he wakes up, and he's still in the garden, and he's relieved that he's not being beaten to death. And then he falls asleep again. He's back in the garden. It's like, well, who is the true self, you know?
Right.
And it's not the waking state or the dream state. It's the one who can observe that I am awake or that I'm asleep, that I'm dreaming. And there's a place, you know, even because when you're in your dream and you come to that awareness that says, I'm dreaming.
Right.
You're still in the dream. You know what I'm saying?
Still in the dream. Right.
Right. Yeah, dream within a dream.
And now you're aware that I'm having a dream. This is not real.
Yeah.
That's the person he's talking about. The one who knows that. And I think we all have it. You know, it's like, you know, I got to wake up from this dream. I know I'm having a dream. And anyway, that's, you know, I love this stuff. It just, it'll make you crazy, though. It's crazy making. You know?
Right.
Well,
because
that's
we keep
good,
trying
because
to wrap
sometimes
our minds.
That, sometimes that crazy place is more sane than not. You know,
oh, absolutely.
Because when we're stuck in our belief in separation, that's insanity. You know, that's where we're
absolutely
believing in the lesser use of the power. And the greater
absolutely
use of the power is a higher consciousness that we talk about. Now, that, to me,
yeah,
is sane. However, I was walking on the street today going to work, and walking next to me, we just ended up walking next to each other, was a young woman, and she was just talking out loud to herself. And I instantly knew that, okay, well, here's going to come a conversation. And we walked for about maybe 50 feet, and she knew I was there, I knew she was there, and she just looked over at me, and I looked at her, and I'm like, you enjoying the day? And she said, oh, yes, it's a wonderful day. She started talking to me the same way she was talking to herself. I was like, this is great, you know. And we kept talking and walking. And then when it came time to split up, she just kept walking and talking as though I was with her or the same way she was talking when I wasn't with her. I was like, that is amazing, you know, like, she was just totally free to be that, you know, and she didn't sound like what we would call crazy. I thought she might have been on a Bluetooth, earpiece for her phone because she was just having a normal conversation out loud. And it's like
with herself.
That. Yeah,
yeah,
with just herself. She was marveling at the buildings, and she started and watching a construction site, and she was saying out loud how, boy, I sure am afraid of heights. I wouldn't want to be up there. You know, sure looks scary up there, you know. And we just started talking. And she was telling me how scared she is of heights. I said, well, how high do you have to be scared? And, I mean, I don't have to go over the whole conversation, but it was like she just continued talking after we left. And I'm like, wow, you know, that's really, I would not call her crazy. You know, I would call her in her right mind.
After we left?
Well, after we split up.
Oh, okay.
After we left each other.
After she kept talking.
Well, no, I'm talking about me, myself, and I, we, you know.
Right.
After we left her.
Yeah. I like me, myself, and I, we, too. But
you know, well, here's the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when we consider the fact that who we are is really we're a collective. We're not a solitary individual. We believe because we occupy what looks like a single unit of flesh, a bipedal, you know, organism. that we are, you know, that thing. But we're so much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
We're so much more than that. You know, Hajra began talking about, you know, anything happens to her grandchildren, it happens to Hajra. You know,
right.
It's like, I know
it
anything
does.
Happens
it
to
does.
Your sisters or your mom or your dad, it happens to you, Rodney.
Yes.
You know, we are so much more than just the solitary, well, biological unit that we come to identify ourselves with. And because we are stuck believing that that's who we are, you know, it makes it difficult for us to accept different ideas about who we are because we can't let go of a form that we see. We say, no, this is it. But we have different, when people, you know, plead insanity, you know, they say that I didn't know what I was doing. Well, why didn't you know? What happened to you when you did that thing that you lost your sense of right and wrong? This is a person walking down the street who's completely content, you know, to talk to herself about being afraid of heights, and then when somebody else engages, she engages that person. When you leave, she keeps talking to herself. She's having her own little reality that some people would say is insane. But, you know, not to her. And so, you know, to me, insanity is just people who are having a reality that the majority do not understand. And so, you know, sometimes they make it criminal for you to have it. But anyway, I don't know. I'm getting twisted in my own conversation.
Well, I want to say that leads us into the next section toward a different order of reality. So thank you very much for that segue.
Yeah. Well, I'm good at doing that inadvertently. So I guess,
you know. Absolutely. So he says, Eckhart Tolle says, and this is on page 164 in the hardcover, toward a different order of reality.
And it's 197 in the paperback.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And he says, the body does not die because you believe in death. The body exists, or seems to, because you believe in death. Body and death are part of the same illusion created by the egoic mode of consciousness.
You need to have a suit on.
Which has no awareness of the source of life and sees itself as separate and constantly under threat. So it creates the illusion that you are a body, a dense physical vehicle that is constantly under threat. Okay. So, yeah, and yeah, if it gets a little noisy in your background, you can put it on mute for a moment. And so So basically, he says, body and death, one illusion. You cannot have one without the other. You want to keep one side of the illusion and get rid of the other, but that's impossible. Either you keep all of it or you relinquish all of it. You cannot escape from the body, nor do you have to. You know, and I like this. He says, the body is an incredible misperception of your true nature. But your true nature is concealed somewhere within that illusion, not outside it. So the body is still the only point of access to it. So if the body is an illusion, and we are believing in the body, then the body becomes the gateway to the true nature of who we are. But if we don't believe that, then what?
If we don't believe what, then what?
If we don't believe in death and the body and death, he says it's an illusion. So if we don't believe the illusion, where is our consciousness?
If we don't believe in the illusion of the body?
Right.
What's the question? Where is what?
It says because your true nature is concealed somewhere within that illusion.
Right. Yes.
Not
right,
outside.
Right. Yeah.
So the body is still the only point of access to it. However, that's because he's saying that we have a misperception of our true nature. Well, wait a minute. Yeah. Body and death, one illusion.
Yeah, so then here's a question for you to ask. At least the question that comes up to me for this is, do I have a body?
Right.
You know, he says it to me, well, do I have a body? You know, do I have this body? You know, I mean, what does that mean that I have a body? As if this body belongs to me. Who is the me that this body belongs to? I mean, it asks a lot of questions. It opens up a bunch of stuff to talk about. I'm fascinated by the concept that, you know, we die because we're under the illusion that we have a body, and since we're convinced that all form is temporary, then therefore my temporary form must, you know, this form that I've assumed is my body is also temporary. And so death is inevitable if form is temporary and I have form. So do I have form? You know, that's the thing. I mean, you know, what he's saying, you know, this is what I'm saying, this is deep down in the rabbit hole. Okay, he says, and I've heard other quantum mechanics say this, that there's no such thing as an objective universe. And basically he said the only reason anything has form is because we all agree that form
yes.
exists and it's here, and we're all, you know, having a similar experience of form.
We're
but
all in
that
the same
who
game.
We are.
Right.
Right, and so, you know, he's saying, you know, we don't have to believe that, and when we stop believing it, we no longer have form, and not only that, he's saying we don't even need to have form. So, you know, it's kind of, I've often heard that, you know, having a body, and this has been my experience, is like, you know, it's like getting drunk, you know, it's like getting drunk, it's like, you don't, that's not your natural state, but if you drink every day, it's certainly going to seem like it.
Right.
You know, but,
yeah. So you get sober, and then we get sober, and like, what am I doing here? This is not.
Yeah, then all of a sudden
you're
having a completely different reality. you know, than when I was drinking. And so it's how deep down, you know, when we start talking about, oh, you know, my body is a, and even Rumi says it. He says that if you're not enlightened, then this is a prison for drunks. But it's not a prison for drunks if you're enlightened. You know, easy. You know, but if you don't know who you are, then this is a prison.
It's very much like
state of,
yeah, it's like Hadra was saying earlier, you know, about being the dreamer, you know, and dreaming this existence. And I'd like so then where is the dreamer?
Right.
Yeah, where is the dreamer dreaming from?
You know, but my question with him when he comes to is, if he's saying that we don't need the physical body or we don't need the form, then what's the purpose of the form?
For the experience of the form.
Yeah, well, you got to have some form to party in, you know. It's like, you know.
I think that there's something attractive about form, obviously, or
yeah,
why would we create
obviously,
it?
Obviously, yeah, because we got it,
yeah.
You know.
This is how
but
right,
I wonder,
you know,
if that should go into the purpose of it, though. If he's saying that it's all an illusion, okay, and it's not a necessary illusion, then my question to him is, what is then the opposite of that, and is there opposite of that? He says, you're not separate from it. There's no objective world out there, which I agree. What we experience is our experience of how we live it and how we perceive it and what's happening in, as and through us. But at the same time, there is an objective world out there that we experience. And we have a subjective experience of that world. And that's
no,
what I see.
He's not saying that there is no objective world out there that we're experiencing. He's saying the opposite. He's saying there's no objective world out there that you're experiencing. That the only reason we have something called the universe is because we agree that there's something called the universe. And that if we
right,
stop agreeing that the universe exists, poof.
It'll be gone.
So for now, at least until we finish the show, we'll agree that there's still a universe.
Yeah, so
now,
we're all agreement with that.
That's a serious rabbit hole, yes.
That's a serious
right,
rabbit hole, right?
A serious, serious rabbit hole, yes.
Well, but what that comes back to, though, in this question about the body, all right? So we've all agreed to have the experience of the body. Not all
right,
energy, not all consciousness has a body. Okay,
right,
this is where the concept of disembodied spirit. It's not
right,
always a disembodied spirit. It could
uh-huh,
be a spirit that never had a body, never chose to have a body. It's not
they
interested
have
in that. Or maybe
right,
not able to vibrate on a frequency where we can create body. You know,
right,
and so
I understand.
And so, you know, if we can accept the fact that what we are is consciousness incarnated, okay, or what I think Dr. Holmes might have called it congealed consciousness, okay, that
okay,
then we begin to understand that our true state is consciousness, and this is, you know, the body is like the clothes we put on for this particular dance that we're doing. Remember, we're immortal beings that last a millennium, never having been born, and therefore never dying, and so this mortal coil, so to speak, where we spend 100 years, 125 years, 200 years, is not even a blip in something called eternity. Because time itself is something that we created so that we could organize the events that we're having in the body.
It's another illusion. Yeah. It reminds me of a movie, I don't remember the name of it, where there was this little boy who did not want to be born. And he slowed up.
That's the story, right?
He slowed everybody else up. So until he was born, nobody else could be born. So he was next,
wow,
and he said, you know what? I don't want to do this. I don't want to go. And he had been evading it for a long time, and everybody else, I guess, was going ahead of him. But the Creator was like, no, you got to go. If you don't go, nobody else goes. You know, so this what was the word you used? Disembodied spirit?
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Had to finally take a body, take form. And his taking form would lead to other beings of form on the planet getting to a greater state of awareness and, I guess, their enlightenment. You know, so it seems as though it's like this great board game or something that the Creator plays with itself. You know, it's like, okay, let me see if I can get all the pieces to pass go and be enlightened. You know, but we're all going along this board game, you know, in all this different form to get back to enlightenment, the place from whence we first came. And that's what, however, we can't get there by ourselves. You know, we just can't roll the dice and move ourselves. You know, we need all these other pieces on the board to get to where we get to go. For some reason, to me, I mean, that's one of the only reasons I can think of besides the Creator just is so full of itself and just wanted to see how much wonderful love it can make on the planet and decided to make all this existence as we seem to know it, unless it's all just a wonderful illusion and we think that it's all existing and it doesn't. But we're all buying into it and all playing the same board game of how beautiful love is. Yeah.
Well, we're all buying into it, and we're all playing the same game. There's no question about that. Because we're all convinced that we're alive and that we have a body and that it's going to die.
And thus far, nobody has been able to beat that game and change those rules of the game.
As far as we know. As far as
we
know.
We create
the
rules as we go.
Now, I had Dr. Kim Kaiser, and I know you know him, Moata.
Yeah, I know.
I believe you do. Dr. Kim Kaiser over there in Santa Rosa.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And he was talking on our conference call, and he was saying one of the tenets in Buddhism is that nobody gets enlightened unless everybody gets enlightened. You know, not one person can get enlightened unless everybody does. And in the middle of the book, middle of 166, he says, the strange Buddhist saying that every tree and every blade of grass will eventually become enlightened points to the same truth, that everything will be enlightened. It says, according to St. Paul, the whole of creation is waiting for humans to become enlightened. And it's like, but we can't, not one of us can get there unless we all get there. And that's what the Buddhist saying is. Like, you are all playing this board game, and not one of us gets to cross go by ourselves. We all, you know, all or nothing. Because there's only one. There's only one mind. There's only one life. So even though we think we're all separate beings, we're all one. So in the event that at some point we're thinking, oh, I'm going to get there before everybody else, no, that's thinking separation.
Well, so
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, as I listen to that, you know, part of me wants to say, oh, that's not true. You know, I mean, just dismiss it right off the top. You know,
I'm just
walking
it
away
up.
Like a, you know. But, you know, I mean, this is what happens sometimes. I hear something and because I think I'm the smartest person ever. If it doesn't make sense to me, therefore it's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. And I'll just dismiss it. You know, but because I have an observer who can see me do that, he smiles and says, there you go again, there you go again, you see? And I'm like, oh, man, I never get to have any fun, you know? And so then I have to go back and look at it again. And so, and in that vein, you know, understanding that there's only one of us here, how many of us need to be enlightened? See, that would be all of us, which would
all
only be
us.
One of us.
All
you
of
know,
us has
still
fun.
Needs one of us.
That's right.
You know? And so that's the part that it makes you crazy because we keep trying to wrap our mind around this thing called all. But if we can wrap our mind around it, it's not all. Because what's outside the mind, we have to dissolve into this idea and let go of everything we think we know about everything else. And then we get to experience something completely different than everything we've ever known before because it includes all the stuff we haven't been able to continue to experience before.
Yeah.
So we dissolve into the oneness. Understanding it.
And that's so true. So, on that note, I'd like to thank everybody for their participation. Thank you for Pierre Angeli and Brenda's listening and Reverend Hajra and Reverend Moata. My name is Rodney Gittins, and this is One Love Center Presents The Power of Now. So on that note, we're going to leave off and pick up again next week, continuing on into The Power of Now. This is One Love Center. We'll be meeting again July 20th. And we just invite each and every one to participate. Also, feel free to contribute to One Love Center. I didn't Okay, everybody, thanks. Hey,
okay.
Brenda, say hello if you can. The show is over, Brenda. If you want to say hi, you certainly can. Hey, it looks like Mwata jumped off.
He did?
Yeah, he did. Probably went to go play with his grandkids. All righty.
Oh, wow.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Hey, did you get my text that I sent you?
Yes,
we
I did.
Talking?
Uh-huh. Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because for a while, you know what I mean? It was like, you got it right. 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 You know. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I can understand that. So I got to practice that because, yeah,
right,
I do that.
Right, right. And another thing that I do my best to practice is to ask questions. So,
yeah.
You know, when you're moderating or just, you know, in a forum, ask questions. So even after you
right.
make a statement.
Yeah, you ask the question, follow up.
Ask a question. Or just, you know, jump in and ask a question. And
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, it just keeps it keeps moving in that way. So it was nice because, you know, Pierre Angeli, I asked a question and she gave a nice answer. And then, you know, we can talk more and then ask another question. Or read the book
mm-hmm.
and then ask a question.
Right. I'm conscious of saying right.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned that a long time ago. And you become conscious of it, you become aware, and then you just start including other things to say or you know, anything, and just find the part to break in.
Right. Okay.
So most of the time, people will just keep talking, and you have to break in.
Right. Yeah, you do have to break in at some point. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a practice, because I say that right thing is a habit. That's
yeah.
a pretty deep habit. Yeah.
Right, right. Okay, my love. Oh, listen, I gave Akiko a check, but she'll cash it, I guess, when she gets back. So that's $45. And I forgot, and got to write you a check, too.
Oh, wow, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, I'm like, something's missing. Yeah, oh, that's right. Got to write you a check, too. So,
okay.
Are you leaving?
On the 25th.
Okay, right. So
you know what I was thinking? Let me say a couple of things. Did you ever send information for Chuck? Because I haven't been able to get on the internet here. This coverage is very, very spotty, and they just moved here,
uh-huh.
and they don't have access to the internet.
Right.
So I haven't really been able to check it. So that was one thing. So I can't even deal with the Chuck thing because I even left my checkbook at home.
Uh-huh.
So I can't. I can't even write him the check. Mail. So.
Oh, okay. No, don't worry about it. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's
one thing. Then the other thing I was thinking, and Supan and I were talking about it today, is for my birthday, right, is to have a potluck party.
What day is
and
that again? Is 18th?
It's the 18th. It's Friday. It's Friday 2 weeks. Not this Friday, the next Friday.
Yeah, the 18th, yeah.
Right, uh-huh. So that's Friday evening or something like that.
Yes. So potluck where?
We're going to have it at the Loft. It's on St. Oxford between Park and Park and Flushing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah.
I mean,
and so.
Yeah.
And what I was thinking about, because our birthdays are so close together.
Uh-huh.
If you want to do a two-for-one, that would be fine with me.
On what day? The Friday? The 18th?
That Friday. Yeah, it's the Friday. The 18th is my actual birthday. Your birthday is that following, what, Tuesday or Wednesday?
Mine's the 23rd.
Yeah. So the other thing I was thinking, too, you know, if I, you know, to send out these invitations, you know, to email them out for people to come. And to say, you know, in lieu of any gifts or presents for me to make the donation to One Love Center would be
right.
something.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah,
so,
by that time
so,
also,
yeah.
we should have tickets for the show for the okay. You know, for the, but I'm just saying, yeah, but that could be separate, sure.
Yeah.
So today, so, oh, mine is on a Wednesday, so it's 2 weeks from today.
Okay.
Yours
yeah.
is a week from Friday.
Week from Friday, yeah.
And you want to do it on Friday.
That Friday night, yeah.
So at the loft, I haven't been there since, I mean, before it was the loft. I mean, it was, as far as I remember, I think the place I'm thinking about, I don't think we called it the loft back then. It was just a place to go dance.
No, this is not that place at all.
What is it?
This is down in, if they call it the loft, it is not the loft.
No, I know the loft is in Manhattan.
No, not that. This is Brooklyn.
Yeah, I know.
But Tupana just named it the loft. But it's a basement apartment that Alvin has fixed up. It's really nice, and they have parties and stuff like that there. And so that's why we celebrated 3/16/16.
Uh-huh.
And it's really it's a nice space. It's a very conducive to party space.
But it's a rental space, right?
It's not it's where he lives.
Oh, okay.
He lives there, but he just created this space where he can entertain and have fun because he likes to do that.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. It's so interesting. Great.
Yeah, and so I want to do that. I want to do that. Have a party because it'll just be the week before I leave. And kind of create the invitations to send out.
Uh-huh.
But I was gonna do it over the you know, through the email, send them out, stuff like that. So I just want to know. And then the other thing too, which I like, part of Seattle culture is to have potluck, you know. And so we always have potlucks whenever we.
So how many people can you invite?
You know, I don't know what the limit is in terms of the people who can actually occupy the building at one time. I'd have to see about that and ask him what would be. But I don't know if people want to come and stay the whole time or just come and leave. You know what I'm saying? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm down.
So,
do that.
But I was just, I wanted to float it by you to see how you felt about that. And if or not, you were willing to, because you have the email list and you know people, I don't have all that information, that then once we created the invitation, you could send it out to some folks.
Okay. I'm down. Sounds groovy.
Yeah. You know, there's going to be dancing, you know, and food and, you know, whatever, just like a party.
Okay.
We were talking about possibly trying to do something ahead of time, you know, like meeting at the park and doing something like that, but I don't think that would work out too well because it's Friday and people are still working, you know?
Yeah,
and so folks, if they're going to work, you know, the earliest they would show up would be about 8, 9 o'clock anyway.
Yeah.
So the afternoon is already gone, so just don't even worry about the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And Saturday is not a good day because Sunday is the next day, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's not good because next day we got to show up and have service, you know?
Right, yeah.
So I'm like, okay, so that's not going to work for Saturday night. So Friday night is really the only option, viable option.
Right.
And then it would have to be Saturday, you know, Friday evening, say start at about 9 for people to come, potluck it, and just come and just enjoy.
And you're coming back the 21st or 22nd of August?
Yes, the 22nd of August, yeah.
Right. So that's okay. So I did put, whoops, I think I put the wrong date for September. So you'll be
it was the first Sunday in September, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
No, I got it right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did. I thought. Yes,
okay.
Good. Okay.
All right. Good. So, yeah, okay, I'm down. Thank you. I'm so honored to celebrate my birthday with your birthday. Thank you.
I think it's a good combination myself. Say true.
Yeah, of course.
Thank
you. I think
we work beautifully together. I just love it. I really do. I love it.
Absolutely.
And then what's the September theme so I can
by, if I'm going.
Oh, let me see. I think it's expectancy. Let me look. Yeah. August is vitality. September, I believe, is expectancy.
Expectancy? Okay.
Tell you in just a second. Okay. Yeah. August is vitality.
Uh-huh.
And September is expectancy.
This is the science of mind. 365 days, right?
Say it again?
This is from Science of Mind, 365
days. Yeah, 365
days.
Science of Mind,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure we're on the same page. Okay. That works.
And so,
okay.
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, I can't think of how many different ways I've done this, but, you know, the ninth month expectancy and just, it's a time when, you know, the harvest is, you know, stuff is ready for harvest and all that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff. You know.
And it's the birth. I mean, 9 months, hello, that's your
yeah,
birth.
That's what I mean, yeah. Yeah, nine months
yeah.
expected,
yeah.
You know, birth,
yeah. it's the birth.
So,
okay. So,
there's a whole lot of ways you can go with that.
Right. The question I also wanted to ask you, because, you know, I've been out of New York so long, potlucks, is that part of the accepted culture here or not? I just can create my own.
Potluck?
Potluck.
Yeah, sure, of course. Potluck is
okay.
Whatever you want to, you know, bring what you want.
Yeah, bring what you want, yeah. But see,
yeah.
That's basically the culture in Seattle. Everybody is potluck. Whatever you do is always potluck, you know?
Yeah, we do
and
potluck here.
They'll tell you if it's not potluck. They'll tell you, not potluck, this is a catered event.
Right.
You know? And then somebody will still bring some food, and they're like, no, don't bring any food. Is not potluck, it's a catered event. So the exception
right.
is not potluck.
No, here
potluck
you got to tell people it's potluck.
Norm. But here you tell people, yeah. But
if you don't tell them, they're not bringing a thing. You can forget that.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
okay,
put potluck
so
about 50 times on the thing. Potluck, hey, it's going to be potluck. Hey, did I say it's going to be potluck? It's going to be potluck, you know?
What
you're
going to
bring? It's
going to
be potluck.
I just love potlucks. They are so much fun. They are just so much fun. They are a blast.
Yeah.
You get to eat. You just get to experience dishes that you haven't experienced, and people make things in different kinds of ways, and they have their stories about their dishes, and
uh-huh.
they're so much fun. I just love them. Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was leaving Seattle, they wanted to cater, you know, a dinner, and I'm like, no, I don't want to cater dinner. I want a potluck.
All right.
And they said, hi, Brad. I said, no, I want a potluck. I want everybody to come with their dish. And we just had a ball. It was potluck, and everybody loved it. You know what I'm saying? And we shared dishes and talked. It was great. It was much better than a catered affair because people got to interact over their dishes, you know?
Yeah, well.
Talk recipes and all that. You know,
well, here,
a whole different
it's
thing.
A little bit different. Because folks are going, you know, this is not so much of a cooking society, you know.
Uh-huh.
And folks will stress it out until the day before and then go
uh-huh.
somewhere and pick up something, you know. you only have a few people who will cook, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like Debbie will cook. I mean, I'm just saying, Brenda will not. She'll pick up something.
You'll pick up something, yeah.
Yeah, Brenda will not cook, you know, absolutely not. I might cook.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
I cook, but.
Well, I'm not against going to Costco and picking up a few things myself.
Yes.
I am not against that at all.
Right.
Nope, I
yeah,
am not.
Nothing wrong with that.
Costco makes some pretty good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. They
yeah,
make perfect
they make
stuff for potluck.
That's right. So they make perfect potluck dishes. All you got to do is heat them.
Yeah.
Make them in the oven and bring them on, you know. I'm all for that. But,
yeah
I just want to find out, you know, how to do in terms of culture and stuff like that.
That's
how
fine.
How that feels here. Okay, that's good.
No problem.
Okay. All righty.
All
that
right.
That's good.
Yeah.
All righty. And so, we'll put both of our names on the invitation, right?
Okay, yeah, okay. I'm all for it. Thank you.
Okay, great.
right, thank you.
So that was fun. I'm glad Pierre Angeli is his woman, or she's his.
Oh, she's her man.
They live together out there. Yeah.
But that's not his wife.
Well, they're not legally married, but they're common law, I guess you say.
Uh huh. How long have they've been together? A while. That's the one he's talked about all the time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they've been
when
getting together.
When he first his wife, that's the one he's talking about, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a good while.
Uh-huh.
Let me see. How long? Years or?
Uh-huh.
Let me see. 12, 13, 14, 15, something like that. Maybe long.
Uh-huh.
I think about maybe 15. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Give or take a few years.
Yeah, give or take, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yep. Now, they weren't living together all that time, but they've been living together probably the last 6-7 years or something like that.
Okay. Is that the woman with the sons that he was talking about?
Yeah.
His stepson?
That's the one, yeah.
Okay. That's the one. Okay. All right.
Yeah, so
well,
she's
I'm
a practitioner,
here.
And, you know, she's wonderful. She's also an educator. She just became principal this year. Well, this last year she became principal.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally escaped me to mention that. But, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, so that was good. That was good.
Yeah.
All right, my dear.
Yeah. Well, listen, I wanted to tell you, I'm down here in Maryland right now.
Uh-huh.
And then we're going to go down to Virginia.
Wow.
And then we'll be back in New York on Sunday.
Oh, okay. Cool. Well, have a great,
mm-hmm.
continue to have a great trip.
Yes, it's been a beautiful trip. It really has been. And I just feel really, really blessed. These moments, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Because this is the third time they've taken a trip out of town. Remember, and I told you I didn't go before?
Right, right.
And so this time I had told them I was going to go on the next trip.
Yeah, they ain't going to hold you to it.
Yeah, so they're like, as part of it, you're going to come, right? I'm like, yep, I got to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'm really
glad I did because I'm having a blast. Yes, I am.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good, good, good.
Yep, it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Life
is good.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
I will talk to you soon.
Okay, you take care. Tell Brenda
right.
I said hi. Okay.
Tell everybody I said hi.
Will do.
And it's
okay.
a great pleasure seeing your family in church.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that was great. That's fun.
It's good to see them come out, you know, and do their thing. It's really, really nice, you know. And it's really amazing to me because they're all so happy for me too, you know.
Uh huh.
Even Yahya, which I was surprised. I wasn't expecting, you know. It's like, you know, he's this staunch Muslim, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been doing this. And so I was like, you know, I was like, his reaction to this is going to be, you know. And he was like, you go, girl.
All right. Oh, that's great. That's great.
Then I saw him, then you forwarded me an email that he sent you.
Yes. I was like, wow. I had just seen it. I don't know why I didn't see it before. So, I forwarded it. So that was great.
Yeah, that's a good thing. But they all seem to be very, very happy and very pleased with what I'm doing. So, and that's really a good thing. So I'm like, okay, this is good. This is very good.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
okay.
Reverend Ian asked about you, and I sent him the email that I sent out. I thought he was on the list.
Okay.
And so he texted me and asked how it went. And I said, oh, it went well, flying colors and everything. And so I sent to him.
I emailed him, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I guess maybe at some point he'll email you.
Okay.
Now, the next thing, our next step is for me to get that letter and get the letter sent in and get all that paperwork, whatever that looks like, completed.
Oh, you mean the letter of call?
Yeah, I have to call Diane Ferguson, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody down here to get the paperwork. But I'll do that when I get back.
That's not the letter of call. You mean something else.
No, I'm talking about the letter of call, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's
yeah.
What we do. They don't do it, have anything to do with that.
I know, but is there a particular form or something that needs to be filled out or information?
There are suggested forms, and
uh-huh.
You can talk to different ministers, and it'll all be different. And ours is going to be different because we're a teaching chapter.
Right.
Some things will be the same, like the percentages of doing a workshop in a class and
uh-huh.
You know, if there's a salary involved or, you know, the
uh-huh.
How much you get for doing a talk, and does
uh-huh.
One Love Center pay for travel or registration for events or,
uh-huh.
You know, things like that. So I don't
uh-huh.
know. And, you know, we'll find, because there aren't many ministers that I can think of. There's one there is one upstate New York. We can introduce you. She was a practitioner and has since become a minister
uh-huh.
in, like, Rochester or somewhere up around there.
Okay.
So she would be the person to check with.
Okay.
And, because mostly it's not ministers who have a teaching chapter.
Right.
So... since she had a teaching chapter, and she probably it still is a teaching chapter now that she's a minister.
Uh-huh.
She's probably only in the last 2 years, I think, she became a minister. So
okay.
She's a great, great resource, and I can't even remember her name right now, but
okay.
There's only but a handful of us in New York State. So
okay.
There's us in the city, and then she is... like, I don't know, I think it's past Albany. It might be Rochester. I don't think it's Buffalo. But
okay.
It's something like that, where she's out there in that direction.
Okay.
And I can't remember her name. Oh, anyway. I'll reach out to her, and I'll do an introduction email, and then you guys can converse and, you know, introduce you two to each other in the same email or something.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, yeah, but she's wonderful. She's supportive and everything. Because she graduated as a practitioner, I think, when I was just starting.
Okay.
And then she kept going to ministerial and, you know, graduated, I think, last year or the year before. I don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah,
how
but
long
she
was
on the fast
how
track.
Long when you how long was between your practitioner graduation and you starting ministerial school?
Well, we were in, I think she was leaving when I was coming in, like the same year I was
okay.
in, she was leaving, I think.
Right. But what was your gap? What was your gap?
My what?
What was your gap between the two?
Between ministerial and practitioner? Well,
right.
I became,
uh-huh.
when I became licensed, I had intended to take time off. Because I was still, you know, doing church, Creative Light Church, and before that I was in college. I was studying substance abuse counseling, so I finished that. And at the same time, I was doing practitioner, so I was doing both
uh-huh.
at the same time. And
uh-huh.
then that ended, and then I was still doing prac for another year, and then that
uh-huh.
ended. But I was still doing
uh-huh.
church, and I was just
uh-huh.
like. I was like toast. I mean, I'm like, wow.
Right.
I had surgeries, like back-to-back surgeries in the middle of all of that. And I said, wow. So I started taking ministerial classes without being matriculated.
Okay.
And I did that for about a year or a year and a half or two or something like that. So I didn't become matriculated right away, and that kind of slowed, that definitely, because I had classmates that had became ministers right away.
Right.
But I took time off, so it was, and it's still a slow process. I mean, I think I have to take a loan or something because, you know, it's just, I got to take a lot of classes. It's just too expensive the way it is now.
How far are you in the process?
Well, you know, I'm like halfway through. I should be further along. I mean, I use the word should for the amount of years that I've been taking classes. The thing is, taking two classes at a term is not enough.
Right.
I really need to be taking three or even four, which is crazy in a way. But
Because that's full time.
Yeah, but I got to, you know, they don't let you take classes forever. You know.
Okay. They have a time limit on it?
Yeah, supposedly, yeah. So I'm on a five-year plan, and I'm in, like, year three. However, I'm still needing to take a lot of classes. So, yeah. I mean, my salary, there's just no way I can do that. So I'm just trusting, you know, the divine idea will come forth. And I realize I have to change something that I used to say years ago when I first started taking classes. I'm like, you know, if I'm going to study for this, do this, I don't want to be, because I used to go to everybody's ordination, everybody's installation as minister. And they were all like, you know, much older folks, you know, and I'm like, I don't want to do that. Well, I'm much older now. It's created into the thing that I didn't want. I just realized that, like, you know, last year, the end of last year, I'm like, you know what? I heard it. I heard that echo. Like, that's not what I wanted to do. But that's what ended up happening. I wanted to do this before I was 60. It's not going to be that. It's not going to happen. Not going to happen.
Well, you know, at least you had an idea that you wanted to do it. I didn't have an idea that I wanted to do it.
Well, I wasn't
focused
on doing it until, you know, I became a practitioner. And then my second year, I mean, look, everybody was on Ricky and Michael Beckwith, everybody, even before I was practitioner. When are you going to be minister? When are you going to be minister? I got to be a practitioner first. Okay,
right.
You know, they didn't even hear that stuff. So, and everybody, you know, Reverend Trish up in Virginia, and everybody was like, Rodney, get your license. You know, I'm like, yeah. But I didn't feel the calling until, like, my second year practitioner, you know, second year prac.
Yeah. Okay.
Then that's when I heard it. That's when it started. That's when, you know, I mean, everybody's calling me Reverend Rod. You know, it's like, eventually it's like, boing, you know, like, oh.
Yeah.
When I started calling myself that, you know, because people would, I would say, well, no, I mean, I'm not a licensed minister. And they're like, stop that. You know, just stop. You know.
Right.
And so I said, okay, I surrender. Talk about resistance. Whew.
Well, now that you put it that way, I guess I went through something similar, but I was just like, I'm not doing it. I'm not going there. It's not for me, you know. But obviously it was.
Yeah.
And here I am.
Yep.
Doing what I said I wasn't going to do, which is what my girlfriend told me. She said, because I wasn't going to be a principal either.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, for years, I was like, no, I'm not doing that, you know. I mean, it must have been a good 10 years, people saying, so, are you a principal yet? Are you going to be a principal? What school are you a principal? Like, I'm not a principal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a classroom teacher, you know. Oh, no, you're going to be a principal. I'm like, no, I don't think so. You know, and I was quite content with that, you know. And then the same thing with this ministerial thing, you know, people at CSL thought I was one of the ministers. I was like, no, I'm not, you know. They were like, oh, I thought you were like, no, I'm not, you know. So, you know, but in the book, The Calling, they talk about your call and how your call can take different forms. And one of the forms it can take is other people telling you what your calling is.
Yeah.
They can see it for you. And that's what was happening to me. They can see it for you when you can't see it for yourself.
It's like they're on a planet for no other reason.
Yes, but to tell you. This is what you're going to do. I'm like, I don't think so. Oh, yes, you're going to do this. I'm like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And there you go. There you go. It's like, okay. I'm like, okay. So,
I was like, I got somewhere else to be. Would you hurry up and be what you're supposed to be so I can move on?
Yeah. Like, what are you going to do? I mean, I'm tired of waiting here. I got to go.
I'm tired of reminding you what you're supposed to be doing.
Get started, okay? We got other things to do. Program.
That's right.
Like that baby who didn't want to be born.
Yeah.
Program. Yeah.
That's it. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. It's amazing. Life is really something.
Okay, good. Dinner time. I got to go.
Okay. You take care. Me too.
I love
and
you.
I
so
shall
much.
Talk to you later. Love you too. You just don't know how much you mean to me.
Same here.
Your prayer.
Yeah.
You would answer my prayer because I'm like, there could be a conscious black man somewhere.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Well, that's how I felt when I came into this teaching, you know. I'm like, golly, where's all the, I mean, especially, you know, where's all the black women? Because all I saw was like the older white women, you know. I'm like, what? When I first came around, I was like, oh, my goodness, what, you know, it got to be some, then I went to California, and then I started seeing them, you know, but it wasn't happening here, but yeah, you know, it's, life is indeed good, and it's a wonderful dream that we're all sharing, so thank you for sharing a dream. I'm talking to myself.